I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. We all value our privacy, but in 16 states, you have essentially no legal recourse if a nude or sexually explicit photo ends up on the internet without your permission. Other states do have more protections, but they are a patchwork of different laws outlining different rights and penalties. Internet sites like Reddit, Facebook, Google, and Twitter have banned the posting of non-consensual nude pictures on their sites. And earlier this year, California Congresswoman Jackie Speier introduced the Intimate Privacy Protection Act, making revenge porn a violation of federal law, punishable with fines and prison time. So clearly, revenge porn or non-consensual pornography is being taken more seriously, but there are still misconceptions about the impact and the dangers of this kind of harassment. We have three guests who have joined us. Anisha Vora was a victim of non-consensual pornography. She's the Assistant Director of Victim Services at the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. Anisha, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And I should add, she is joining us by Skype. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Jim Carpenter, Chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Jim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone, Danielle Keats-Citron, Professor of Law at the University of Maryland, also the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. And Danielle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
Anisha, let me begin with you, and I know that you've told this story before, and I thank you in advance. How did you find out that your former boyfriend was posting nude photos of you online? Do we have Anisha?
I actually received an anonymous email. Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Barely.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I actually found out because I received an anonymous email from someone, and they were letting me know that there were pictures of me all over the internet and that they believed that it was my ex-boyfriend.
And what did those pictures reveal, if you don't mind me asking?
Some were pictures he had taken of me that I had no knowledge of, and some were pictures that I had sent him since we had a long-distance relationship. And there were pictures of me, like, topless or just, like, nude pictures that I had sent him.
What was the response of strangers? And I was reading, because not only did he post these photos, he also posted your address and other personal data. People even coming to your doorstep and leaving photos.
Right. So it went from one extent, and then it completely escalated, and it became my worst nightmare. I had people messaging me, people I didn't know sending me pictures of them nude. I had Facebook messages, emails, text messages. I had people showing up at my door because he was telling people that I had a rape fantasy and to just let themselves in, and if I said no, it was fine, to just keep continuing.
Wow. You did go to the police. What was their response?
At the time, I lived in New Jersey, and I was extremely lucky. I had gone to the police, and they were very helpful. They wrote up like an incident report, and then they kept following up on it, and they were trying to do everything they could. They had asked me off the bat if I knew who had done it. And obviously there was only one person who had access to all these pictures. So once I'd given the cop his information, he was able to follow up and basically bring my ex in for an interview.
And what happened to him?
He denied everything at first. And then I guess the cops scared him a little bit and he admitted to it at that.
You know what?
I was able to restrain him. We went through court and everything, and he was charged with a misdemeanor at the time.
Anisha, I hate to do this to you, but we are losing our connection to you on Skype. Why don't you hang up? We will call you back, and we will continue our conversation. I do apologize having to do that, certainly in the middle of your story. Jim, you're sitting across from me. Does this sound like a familiar story from your perspective?
Yes, we've seen a fair amount of this type of behavior and this type of criminal conduct. We're fortunate that we do have a revenge porn statute that went into effect in September 2014. So We do believe it's very underreported because of the nature of it, the very, very, very fact that these are private images and who would, you know, want to go to the police. But we would encourage people to come to the police because we will handle it with discretion. And it's frankly just horrifying that somebody would be betraying someone in that manner. And we have men and women doing it. We've prosecuted about 17 to 20 cases already. Sometimes it's an ex-boyfriend, as it was in Anisha's case.
Yes.
And, you know, we have situations where ex-girlfriends may have naked pictures of their ex-boyfriend, and when they break up, they send the pictures to the boyfriend's father, to his aunt, to other people. And it's absolutely, terrifying to have that out there and humiliating and a lot of shame. And people need to realize that they are victims and, you know, that it can be prosecuted.
Danielle, let me get you in on the conversation. And then, Anisha, we will go back to you. New Jersey was actually one of the first states to take what we're calling revenge porn, non-consensual pornography, or the posting of nude photos or sexually explicit photos without someone's permission. New Jersey kind of leading the country. Where do we stand today?
So there are now 34 states and the District of Columbia that criminalize in some form, whether a misdemeanor or a felony, the practice of, so criminalizing it as a practice of non-consensual pornography, some narrow, some broad. But we've made some significant progress at the state level because the first law, you said rightly, was New Jersey, and that was 2004.
Right.
And we've seen a real flurry of interest at the state legislative level in the last 2 years. So we've made much of that progress from one state or two states to now basically 35, right, 34 plus D.C., and that really happened in the last 2.5 years.
Let me go back to you, Anisha, and you were telling us about the fact that you did go to the police. Your boyfriend was brought in for questioning. Then what happened?
So once he was brought in for questioning, they were able to make the arrest, and he was handcuffed, fingerprinted, mugshot, all of that. He was actually released to his dad, and after that, I was able to come in and get a restraining order. So obviously, that was a temporary restraining order, and then I was able to go to court to make it a final restraining order, which to this day I still have. He was then we had to go to like the criminal aspect of court, and it was actually downgraded from a county level to a municipal level. So here I was in traffic court telling my story in front of all these people who had traffic tickets, and he was charged with a misdemeanor. At the time, the judge wanted it to go back up to the county level. I was just so exhausted at that point. I just wanted to get it over with, and I was like, let's just finish this here and be done with it. We can both move on with our lives. And at the time, I was like, you know what? People make mistakes, and I gave him that chance. As soon as court was over, he continued to post, and this is when it became worse. Wow. And he started putting out my address, my phone number, where I went to school, my everything. It was just such a big violation of my privacy, and people started showing up at my door. So now I was fearing for my safety and my family's safety, because at the time I was living at home with my parents. So at that point, we ended up going back to court. And he was arrested again on violating the restraining order that was in place. We were able to bring this back up to the county level. And after going to court a few times, he was charged with a third degree felony of invasion of privacy.
And served some time, I guess, in prison. Were you able, or have you been able, Anisha, to essentially erase all these pictures of you that were living on the internet?
No, and to be honest, I don't think I ever will be able to completely get rid of them. What I do is I pay a takedown service annually, and they monitor my pictures, and they remove them as they come up, or they request for them to be removed. But I was literally on 3,000 links. I went from three links to 3,000, and it literally almost happened, like, within a couple weeks. It escalates so fast, and you lose control, and there's nothing you can essentially do, because if I sat at home and just found these websites all day, I would go crazy.
Sure.
So I'm lucky to have the company that I do. They're called CMCA Defender, and they actually monitor everything and take them down. But at the end of the day, like if it goes unmonitored for long enough, it'll just come back.
Anisha, was this in New Jersey?
Yes.
Let me just pick up on that, because Danielle, as you said, New Jersey really led the country in terms of taking this more seriously than other states going back to 2004. And yet we hear Anisha's story and it doesn't feel as if her case was taken particularly seriously, at least in the beginning.
Right. And that is not surprising. You know, the law in New Jersey has been significantly underenforced. We've seen about three or four prosecutions between 2004 and 2013 at the time I wrote my, you know, published my book. And so Anisha's experience is terrifying and equally ignored by law enforcement. New Jersey isn't alone in that respect. So often when people report non-consensual pornography and the sort of suffering that Anisha has experienced, the response is often, you know, turn your computer off, ignore it, it'll go away, it'll drop down in a search of your name. And it's not because always that law enforcement is insensitive, it's just that they lack the training to really understand the harms that victims experience. And equally, they lack the training on the law, that there are laws in their states now that they can enforce. And it sounds like the Philadelphia DA's office is being aggressive and taking this seriously, much like we see in California, another jurisdiction that has been really aggressive in thinking hard about ways we exploit sexual privacy. So I'm heartened to hear about Philadelphia, but sadly, you know, Anisha's experience isn't unique.
Jim, what should we understand about Pennsylvania, how the Pennsylvania law looks at this non-consensual pornography?
The Pennsylvania law, it does have some limitations. It's called unlawful dissemination of intimate image. And basically, if someone is an intimate partner of the victim, and meaning they've had a sexual relationship, and they disseminate or distribute or circulate these pictures, whether it's on the internet or just by sending them to other people, and they do so with the intent to harass or annoy or alarm the other person, that's a second degree misdemeanor. And if it's a minor, it's a first degree misdemeanor. But of course, photographs of anyone under 18 would also fall into child pornography. So, you know, there is a gap in it, in that, and I'm sure Dr. Keith Sitronkin is familiar with sextortion, but, you know, that's another area where non-intimate partners may solicit photographs and then use those photographs to try to get teenagers or young women to engage in sex acts or to extort money and things like that.
And you use the word sextortion, which I do want to pick up on, but sure. Let's take a very short break. Talking with Jim Carpenter, he's the chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Danielle Keats-Citron, professor of law at the University of Maryland, author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. In fact, she was a guest on Radio Times to talk about that book. And Anisha Vora telling us about what happened when her boyfriend posted photos of her, explicit photos of her on the internet, and how she responded and continues to have to monitor the internet to make sure these photos do not keep turning up. And she's assistant director of the Victim Services at the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. More than 30 states have made it a crime to post explicit sexual images on the internet without the permission of the person or persons involved. But that doesn't mean it isn't happening. And again, talking with our three guests about the problem of non-consensual pornography, as it is called, sometimes called revenge porn as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jim, during the break, I asked you, which this is really harassment in terms of understanding how the law looks at this?
I mean, yes, it can be harassment. It can also be classified as stalking. The cases that we're seeing, a lot of them, by the fact that the statute is defined by being an intimate partner, we see a lot of it coming out of domestic violence situations or coming out of broken relationships where one of the people won't let go, are making demands and just want to hurt the other person. And this is just as serious as striking someone with your fist. I mean, to have these photographs put up on Instagram and have literally your aunt calling you saying, I just got this. I just got texted this. I can't imagine what Anisha went through. And we also see it with teenagers. And we've seen those incidents of, you know, the heightened depression. We've seen, you know, girls and boys hurt themselves, you know, because they don't know what to do.
Right.
And going to the police, it is a way that we can work to stop it. As Anisha said, her organization is terrific in terms of trying to get those images off the internet. But there is something about holding that person accountable. You're not at fault for this type of communication. This is what not everybody, I'm old, but a lot of people.
It's not that uncommon.
Do this. A lot of people do this. And it's a form of communication, and it shouldn't be exploited this way.
Danielle, let me go back to you. Do you see this as a civil rights issue?
I do. I think it's worth noting that when men and women do experience non-consensual pornography, though it's more often women who are threatened with the release of nude photos. There's a recent report. There'll be a report that's come out tomorrow by Data and Society that has some more interesting statistics about who suffers it. Mm-hmm. But despite the fact that, you know, we tend to have men and women who are targeted with non-consensual pornography, women tend to suffer more of the brunt of the harm, in the sense that, you know, when a woman's nude photo is posted online, they're viewed as sluts. They're kind of disregarded. They're sexually damaged. When men experience it, it's not to say it's not damaging. It can be, I'm sure, emotionally terribly damaging. But we just as a society tend to view men as like, oh, good for you, guy. You know, you right. Whereas women, we've seen they lose their jobs. So, you know, female teachers who've experienced non-consensual pornography, they lose their jobs, and the response is often, well, we can't have a kindergartner teacher have nude photos of them posted online. The parents can Google it and see. And so it has profound economic consequences. So I understand this. We see it as a civil rights problem, because when you target someone because they are due to their membership in a protected group, and that targeting has a real cost to their life opportunities, like work, that's a civil right. That's when we say, you know, civil rights law has long understood that when we take away someone's important life opportunities, whether it's to work, to speak out, because of just who they are, something they can't avoid, that you're a woman, and it sends the message that they're less than, they're insignificant because they're a member of that class, like that they're a woman.
Sure. Sure.
We see those kinds of consequences.
Anisha, let me go back to you. Did what your ex-boyfriend do to you, did that make it harder for you to get a job or go out in public or do the kinds of things that I think we all take for granted?
At first, everywhere that I'd go, I was always looking over my shoulder. Driving down the street, I'd look at my rear view. And I think that came from people coming to my house. I had a heightened fear for everything I did. When turning onto my street, I'd always check everything before I pulled into my driveway just to prevent myself from being cornered or anything crazy. And I think you start to go crazy because you're literally thinking about every single step you make. And when he first posted it, I didn't think it would become something this crazy. I didn't think it would become this big. I don't think I realized how scared and how scary it can become.
Well, and I'm thinking, I mean, in many ways, Anisha, then you have to be proactive. As you said, you've hired a company to essentially go through these sites and pull down your photo. What about your ex-boyfriend? Is he out and about and living his life?
He's living his life, just moving forward, doing whatever. I mean, like, I don't really keep tabs on him, so I'm not sure, but we grew up together. We became friends in sixth grade. We had a 10-year relationship. We dated for 4 of those years. So a lot of our friends were mutual friends, and I had to make those cuts. I had to cut people out left and right because I couldn't trust anyone. But occasionally I do hear stuff about him. So, yeah, he's living his life. And as far as, like, the job thing, all the interviews I've had since this happened to me, I actually tell them. I come forward and I say something because I'd rather – not that I feel like I owe it to them, but I'd rather be upfront than them go online and be judgmental.
Oh, so interesting.
I,
I talk about it. And I also talk about it in the sense that at first when it happened, I would actually give my restraining order to my employers because I was always afraid. I was afraid that he would show up wherever I was. So just a little heads up.
I hear you. Jim, you're nodding your head. And I'm also thinking the fact that in the last couple of years, I believe Reddit, Facebook, Google, Twitter, they've all essentially banned what Anisha is talking about. Do you think some of these sites do a better job than the law or even law enforcement?
I mean, I think the sites, you know, have an obligation, you know, to take this down. You know, they're not knowing conspirators, but they're certainly providing the mechanism to just, you know, absolutely torture someone. And I can't imagine what Anisha went through, you know, where every knock on the door, you're not sure what to expect. And that's exactly what a stalker does. A stalker tries to take away the sense of security, the sense of safety, the sense of your own identity. It's a control mechanism. It's trying to control them and control your life. And I think Anisha's done a wonderful job of you know, holding him accountable. Yes, there are – I think it's very hard – you know, we have, you know, the fake news on Facebook and I heard one of your stories where, you know, people are looking at it at Facebook for 1 second to decide if it's false or not. I mean, there's a huge volume of photos out there. I think the issue is education, that people become aware that there's a law enforcement response. It used to be, I remember 12 years ago, we had a couple cases where people had naked pictures of their girlfriend. And when they broke up, they made 100 copies at Kinko's and went out and stapled them to telephone poles all over the neighborhood with a phone number. And, you know, that was horrifying. And we would prosecute those as harassment. But the internet has just made it it's just weaponized that whole factor.
Because not only does it get disseminated, but it's hard to know sort of what the source. I mean, it just keeps getting retweeted.
Yeah.
And you're always chasing the source.
It's exponential. You can't just tear down the posters, which is what, you know, we would do. Once that decision is made to send that out there by the perpetrator, it takes a life of its own. It's absolutely horrifying. And we also see that, you know, some of these things, moving into sextortion to a certain degree, can be a gateway to trafficking, a gateway to getting teenagers involved in you know, prostitution and things of that nature.
Using that as a form of a threat, as you were describing earlier.
Yeah, we have cases where, you know, like a 16-year-old girl may meet a guy online and then go have sexual relations with him, and he films it, and then he tells her, I'm going to send these to your parents. I'm setting up a Facebook account in your name unless you come back and have sex with all these other men. And then that progresses. So that would fall within revenge porn because they did have a relationship. But we see men and it's absolutely correct. It does target women. Women are the primary victims in these cases. We've had defendants threaten to send naked pictures of women to their employers to try to get them fired. I mean, it's really horrific.
Daniel, let me go back to you. And in doing research for the show, we were interested in what the ACLU said about some of these laws in the various states. They were concerned about whether just sort of, let's say, consensual nude pictures or arty nude pictures or maybe even pictures of Abu Ghraib, you know, might not be posted because of these pornography or anti-pornography laws. Does that concern you at all?
It does if laws are written too broadly. Right. If those laws, and it's true that some state laws, they're not perfect. They've been challenged and struck down, like in Arizona. And the problem with some of those laws is that they don't include exemptions for matters of legitimate public interest, like would-be photos of Abu Ghraib. And at the same time, they're not tailored to invasions of privacy, that is, circumstances where the victim has a reasonable expectation of privacy and where the defendant knows they don't have permission to post the photos, knows that they're shared or disclosed in circumstances where they expected it to be kept private. And so I think when laws go further afield, they can sweep in their reach images that are truly are not meant to be covered by these laws. And so that's the concern is in the drafting, and you've got to get the drafting right.
Right.
They also can be too narrow, and this is something Jim kind of underscored, that in the Pennsylvania law, it only applies to where the victim is the intimate or sexual partner of the discloser. Now, there are circumstances when, you know, people coerce other people that they're not in an intimate relationship, but you often see young boys, you know, coerce young women into sharing nude photos of themselves. And so, or young women, you know, people in their 20s. And so they're not in an intimate relationship. But once coerced, or even when you secretly tape someone or secretly take a picture and you don't have a relationship and then release those photos, I think those sorts of circumstances should be covered as well. And so we're having a sustained conversation, and I work closely with the ACLU of Maryland in drafting the Maryland, or helping draft sort of versions of the bill that was passed in for Maryland's non-consensual pornography law. And that's work that I think is ongoing.
And that's Danielle Keats, Citron Professor of Law at the University of Maryland. Also with us, Jim Carpenter, Chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, and Anisha Vora, a victim of non-consensual pornography, also known as revenge porn. And she is the Assistant Director of Victim Services at the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. We are talking about policing revenge porn or non-consensual pornography, and you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Nancy from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Nancy, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering, is there something illegal about posting somebody's address and inviting and saying that they have rape fantasies? It seems like this should be illegal even without the photograph.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm looking at you, Jim.
Yeah, that would fall under harassment. So it could be summary, it could be misdemeanor, but committing a series of acts that are just designed to annoy or bother or harass or frighten or alarm another person is classified as harassment. And that's a pretty broad statute, but it may not bring the kind of penalties that something that severe would justify. So it does fall within that realm. But without the photographs, it would not fall under, the revenge porn or the sextortion.
And an email from thanks for the call, Nancy. An email from Jean saying this is a horrible crime that needs swift and strong prosecution. But I must also say, how can anyone put these pictures into anyone's hands? A question from Kevin. Can you sue? This is to you, Anisha. Can you sue your ex-boyfriend since you had to hire a protection company? I mean, it does look like it's sort of fallen on you to police all these photos that may show up on these Internet sites.
I actually, when we went to court, he was responsible to pay for the first year. Anything after that would have been a civil suit. You have to understand that this took 3 years out of my life before Wow. He was actually arrested the second time and went to jail. And I had to focus on school. I had stopped going to school for a while. Everything had just fallen apart and I had let it fall apart and I wasn't going to let him win anymore. So I had to take back my life, and at that point I decided I wasn't going to move forward with it. And it wasn't till maybe like last year that I realized, hey, this is ridiculous. I'm paying $500 a year for me to have to get these pictures taken down, and this is something he should be responsible for. And when I talked to an attorney to maybe go ahead with a civil suit, it was outside of the statute of limitations. So if I hadn't waited, I could have, but I waited too long.
Let me read an email from Amy. She says, does the law that Jim Carpenter is citing also apply to the act of outing another person's sexual practices or history over the Internet, i.e. mailing or making public a former partner's sexual partners or lifestyle as a form of text without the images included? So the idea is saying something about somebody, but not necessarily posting an image of them doing something sexual.
It can be. It can fall within harassment, although harassment often, you know, requires actual communication with the person. Theoretically, it could fall within that. In other words, harassment includes doing acts that have no legitimate purpose but are designed to alarm or cause, you know, pain to another person. But it is, you know, those are very difficult issues. I mean, we do get reports of that, and it can be difficult to prosecute that.
What do you think, Danielle?
And I think also just to add to Jim's insight is that that kind of is I think would understand it as protected speech. That unless it's in the context of a course of conduct that is repeated behavior that is often involving, you know, threats and defamation, when the speech is legally protected speech, and unless it's sent directly to the victim, I think there is rightful pause by prosecutors, because any prosecution could be overturned on First Amendment grounds, and sort of disclosing private information about someone that we would say has some value. We protect speech, even if it's confidential speech. It just depends on the circumstances. But when you're writing about someone's sexual habits that you've experienced and it's truthful information, it may be protected speech.
Is there a difference, though? Danielle, we're almost up at a break here. I mean, if you're a public person or a private person, how we apply some of these laws.
And that's true, but that kind of distinction usually comes up when we're talking about defamation, so false facts about someone, that when, you know, law can step in for a private individual, it may not be able to step in for a public figure because you've got to say the lie with actual malice, right? But when it comes to truthful private information, when it doesn't involve an image and it doesn't involve communications privacy that, you know, Jim underscored, when we're not talking about private communications, but simply someone talking about truthful facts about another person, that's when law tends to be unable to step in because we're talking about, under First Amendment doctrine.
And that's Danielle Cates Citron. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Anisha Vora, a victim of non-consensual pornography. She's been telling us about what happened to her. She's now the assistant director of victim services at the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, a group that provides support to victims, advocates for stronger legislation, consults with tech companies regarding technological solutions to this problem we've been talking about. And Jim Carpenter, chief of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, 1-888-477-9499, the phone number to call to join our conversation and more. You can also post things, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we're talking about revenge porn or non-consensual pornography and what to do about it. It's illegal in some 30 states. A member of Congress, a woman named Jackie Speier, has introduced the Intimate Privacy Protection Act to make revenge porn a violation of federal law, punishable with fines and prison time. 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Again, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Mike from Reading to join us. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Two comments. One is the first girl from New Jersey. You know, she said her old boyfriend was out and about, but he's a convicted felon, so that's not really the best person to be. And then the other thing, I was a teacher for a long time, and you had mentioned about the female teachers, but I worked with a lot of young male teachers who were trying to get their career started. And if old girlfriends had put out nude pictures of them, they would not have lasted very long in the district that I worked. So I think it's, you know, you can say it's more of a female problem, but any young teachers, male teachers, I would have known their careers probably would have been over.
Mike, sure. No, two good points. And let me give Jim, just because you're sitting across from me, go ahead.
I mean, yeah, we see both male and female perpetrators. We see old girlfriends perpetrating on the boy's new girlfriend. It crosses all those barriers. I do think, you know, women are victimized more, but I totally agree with you. If someone were to, get a hold of a naked picture and send it to your boss, I don't know how you deal with that.
Sure.
And having a boss that's sophisticated enough to understand that, let alone a school district that's sophisticated to understand that, you know, this is what goes on, these are private matters, and you shouldn't be punished for that. I think it's quick to have a knee-jerk reaction, and that's what the perpetrator is counting on, trying to destroy you.
Sure. Anisha, anything you want to add to that?
So I agree with him that the felony itself, he's pretty much not going to find a job. And he was going to school for computer science. So it's kind of funny in that aspect because you're going to school for something that you just got arrested for doing something against that. And now no one's going to hire you if you have invasion of privacy on your record. So I know that the last thing I heard was he was a busboy with a double major and a double minor. So I'm pretty sure he's going to have a hard time with the rest of his life. What I meant by he's moving forward is he's like engaged and doing all this stuff with his life. So, but yeah, as far as his future, he's pretty much stuck. But that's his own fault. So,
yeah, and his pictures are not on the internet. So, you know,
right.
I wonder too, Danielle. Do you think having a federal law, if this intimate privacy protection law, is passed by Congress, that is a good direction to go in?
I do. You know, we have certainly 30 plus states that do have non-consensual pornography laws on the books, but that leaves a significant number of states that don't. And so what a federal law would do is protect communications privacy that involves sexual expression and allow federal law enforcement and prosecutors to step in when there isn't a state law on the books or that state law is really narrow. So I think it's an effective move forward, not only just as a practical matter, but what it says. Right, a federal law, the proposal by Congresswoman Speier that Anisha's group, Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, was crucial in helping to draft, would send a really powerful message that when you invade someone's sexual privacy and you do so in a way that undermines privacy and set of commitments to communications privacy, that it's wrong. That there are serious consequences, and that helps educate us and change behavior.
What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the real benefit would be to promote this issue, put it in the public eye, and set a model crime, a model code for the other states to adopt and for states like Pennsylvania to even improve ours. If it becomes a federal law, other states are much more likely to pick it up. And unfortunately, this is I can't even imagine how underreported this crime is, much like, sexual assaults are. But anything that can promote the idea that to offenders, you're going to be held accountable for doing something like this, and to victims that you can go to police and get assistance with this, that you don't just have to suffer.
Do police, I mean, this is a broad question, do police, you think, take it seriously enough? They have a lot on their plate, obviously, that they have to deal with. But is it taken seriously enough in Pennsylvania?
I think generally police take it seriously, but you're dealing with thousands and thousands of different officers. So, I'm pleased that it's been, charged 20 times over the last, 2 years since we've gotten it. And that's been with officers recognizing that this is a crime. Now, Undoubtedly, there's been situations, I'm sure, where people have gone in and the police said, well, there's nothing we can do about that. And that's our job to try to educate people about and our officers that these are particular crimes. But often when they're coming out of intimate partner like this, they're treated by domestic violence detectives who have a better understanding.
And Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Anisha, tweet from P. Edward writes, and if photos have not been taken, you have nothing to worry about. Frankly, I was waiting for someone to come in saying, this is your problem because you were sharing naked photos of yourself with your ex-boyfriend. What do you say in response to a comment like that?
Well, I've found that with a lot of the media I do, they do ask that. And I think that it's crazy that people still have that mentality that this was something between my ex-boyfriend and I. It was something intimate. I trusted him. He was someone in my life for so long. And the fact that he went behind my back and did this, he betrayed me. Me sending him pictures was not a crime. Sucks because of the technology now, and that's how some people look at it. But I, to this day, and I'll stand by it, I didn't do anything wrong. He went behind my back. He betrayed me. He put my life in danger. This was all his decision. So do I feel guilty at all? No.
Yeah.
He did it to himself.
Well, Danielle, it sort of reminds me of one of the arguments about, rape victims or victims of sexual assault. Why were you wearing 4-inch heels? What do you say in response to a comment like that?
I think you're absolutely right that, we've heard these sorts of arguments before that we blame the victim, whether it's a victim of domestic violence, a victim of sexual harassment at work, a victim of sexual assault. Like, you did something to provoke this. And I think Anisha speaks of such an important experience, and I appreciate so much her sharing it with everyone. We should never blame the victim. I think in a world in which our intimate conversations will often involve network technologies, it's just a part of expression and a development of intimacy. That, you know, unlike in my generation, I feel like we made mixtapes as a way to express
You're
our
showing
intimacy.
Your age, Danielle.
I know, I'm 47 years old. Forgive me, right?
Play with John Cusack.
Right? But the younger people, and I have students, I have, you know, young people in my lives, and they use their phones as sort of phones are everywhere where they are. Yeah. And sexual expression and intimacy and confidentiality are all just are important then, important to respect. And if it's a way to express themselves and develop relationships, there's nothing wrong with that. So to blame the victim is to just repeat, I think, frankly, a mistake of the past, that we have long blamed victims when we don't want, you know, when we're too afraid to recognize the harm, and that victims aren't at fault. It's the perpetrators, right? It's the ex-boyfriend who betrayed Anisha's trust and not Anisha.
And Jim, I know you want to add something, then we'll get back to our callers.
Yeah, I would just note, I mean, if you get robbed on the street at gunpoint, the police, I would hope, are not going to say to you, what were you doing outside of your house? So, you know, it's a ridiculous sort of thing to argue, you know, to put it on the victim. How dare you come out of your house? You got robbed. If you hadn't come out of your house, you wouldn't have gotten robbed. I'm not, you know, Philadelphia is a very safe city, but, you know, the fact is we don't do that, except we do it in rape cases. We do it in domestic violence cases. Why do you keep staying with him? Well, because I'm economically dependent on him, because I love him and I have children. You know, why did you send these pictures? Because virtually every teenager is sending these pictures. I mean, parents need to talk to their kids about it so that they're aware of it. But to say it doesn't go on is ridiculous. It's incredibly widespread. And frankly, in the 70s, if they had cell phones, this is what, you know, anyone would have been doing.
Let me see what Bill from Mount Airy has to say. And Bill, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Hi, Bill.
Yep. Hi.
Hi there.
The discussion has all been talking about non-consensual pornography. But it seems to me you have to distinguish between pornography and just nude pictures. Mm-hmm. And the law should prohibit sending the nude pictures non-consensually, as well as if it happens to be pornography.
I actually think that's a really good point. I mean, we use words and language does matter. I mean, Danielle, what is that thing about pornography? I know it when I see it. But there is a difference between what is considered to be pornographic and what could be sexually explicit. At least I think so. What do you think?
Right. I mean, so I always also think pornography implies consent, right? That individuals engaged in pornography, it's a legitimate business, and you've got adults that consent to the taking of their nude images, whether in film or in a photograph. And so that's also, I think what's tough in working on issues involving sexual privacy, it's hard to get a name that captures really what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so we just search for terms that can help people think about these matters. But of course, the key gravamen of what's going on isn't really the problem that it's pornography or that it's obscenity, but rather that what we're disclosing is a nude images that was shared in private in confidence and then disclosed in betrayal of someone's trust and expectation of privacy. So if we could take away the discussion of pornography, I think we'd also be in a good spot.
Yeah.
But it is an easy way for the public to understand the problem.
Yeah. Jim, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, if it's a commercial activity that's protected as free speech, then, you know, that's fine. I would note, though, that, again, this can be a gateway. And for teenagers, we're seeing cases of 15-year-old, 16-year-old girls being solicited online saying, send pics. They then send a pic. Then the man, who's probably a 35-year-old man, says, now you have to have sex with me, which gets back to the extortion. Or you need to send me more pictures. So now I need even more pictures, which they're then probably selling or putting on the internet for pay, or getting the girl into performing sexual acts. So I think you know, that, especially with minors, I think we just have to be aware that even if it's not an intimate partner, parents have to be educating their kids about that danger.
Indeed. Anisha, going back to you, and something Jim has said several times during the hour, which is that oftentimes victims are reluctant to come forward. What would help victims come forward and be able to tell their story the way you've been telling yours?
Well, I understand their fear of coming forward because it's not just dealing with, okay, if I come forward now, my ex is going to harass me more. It's coming forward and telling your family. There's no way I could have done this without telling my whole family.
Right.
So, and especially because I had a fear for my mom and my dad's safety at that point. But I understand the fear. I just think that by speaking out, there's so much more that can be done. So had I stayed quiet and not shared my story, how many other people might not know what to do? There's so many people I've spoken to personally that I feel like as a result have had the strength to go forward and talk to police. You don't necessarily have to come out and tell your story publicly, but to at least be able to go forward and talk to someone about it, it helps you like therapeutically, and also to be able to possibly get the person who has done this to you to be able to move forward with that. And I just think that there's so many people who are so afraid to speak out and to go to the police. And I think part of that's also because of the horror stories of like certain states where police are turning people away and saying, well, it's your fault. You shouldn't have done this.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Anisha.
I just think that at this point, like, because there's so many laws in place that should help people and that there can be something that can be done.
Danielle, anything you want to add to that?
I think Anisha's spot on. Once victims have a sense that law enforcement's going to take it seriously, we're going to see less reluctance to come forward.
A comment from Tim, what recourse does a victim have who loses their job as a result of revenge porn being deliberately or maliciously brought to the victim's employer's attention? Do they have some kind of recourse under those circumstances?
Well, I mean, criminally, you know, that criminal is about holding the offender accountable. So, you know, that would be a private action to possibly get their job back. But I don't practice in that area, but I would think that certainly you could, you know, file an action to, you know, try to get your job back. But I think, you know, the damage is incredible that can be done. And even if you go back to your job, you're going to be with coworkers that, you know all of this, have seen all of this. And as the previous caller said about being a school teacher, I mean, it's devastating.
Right.
But I think the more that it becomes apparent that, first of all, this is not an uncommon form of communication between lovers, and that when it gets publicized, that's a crime. I think recognizing that may make people understand that, you know, you shouldn't fire somebody for something that they were a victim of.
Daniel, I'm giving you the last word, about 30 seconds. Final thoughts before we say goodbye.
I think we should feel encouraged by the work that Jim's office is doing, that we're going to see some progress. It'll be slow and steady, but I hope that Jim's office example is not alone, that we see other states and localities do the same.
And Anisha, I actually am going to give you the final word. Any last thoughts before we say goodbye? Go ahead.
Well, just anybody that's going through this, like, feel free to reach out to the nonprofit. Like, we're always here to help you. We want to make sure that everyone feels that they can communicate and talk about this, and just know that you're not alone, and that we're standing right behind you. We're here to help you. So don't ever feel like you can't communicate or that you can't talk about it.
Well, Anisha, I really appreciate you joining us, sharing your story, a real public service. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the group that she's involved with, the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. Jim Carpenter, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for bringing attention to this.
Absolutely. Danielle Keats Citron, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times.
A pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.